in something like that. I turned up at a youth group in somebody's front room in a little village in the middle of nowhere in Norfolk, mainly because a girl I rather liked invited me along to it. And they said, "We better begin by explaining to you where we stand," they said. "We believe that this book, the Bible, is the Word of God, and that through it he has spoken to us." And I went, well, no, I didn't. But inside, that's what I did. Because, I mean, to me, that just seemed insane. I thought for a minute perhaps I'd missed the place where we were supposed to hook up our brains by the door on our way in order to believe something quite as crazy. In fact, it seemed so crazy to me that I thought, I must stay around and hear what they have to say and then show them how silly and foolish they are to believe such a load of nonsense. And now I'm here trying to explain to you why we can put our confidence in this book, thousands of years old, and we can actually believe that God might speak to us through its pages. I am fully aware that to the total outsider, this seems very weird and very strange. But please bear with me. I'm going to, in as brief but as full a way as I can, give you some reasons why I think this is not a crazy or stupid thing to do. We'll break for a song and in the middle, and some of it will be interactive, so it won't just be a long talk from me. But please listen with an open mind if this is all new to you. And of course, there'll be plenty of things I can't explore or fully explain, because I'm going to throw a lot of points at you, and only if some of them can I really expand on. If that's the case, then all the more to grill me over later on. We need to begin, though, by having a clear idea in our minds as to what the Bible actually is. We have it here as a nicely, neatly bound book, don't we? But actually, of course, the Bible is a collection of books, and there are 66 books and different texts within it, collated together, brought together. It's like a mini library, I suppose. And those books weren't all written at one time. They were written over a period of about 1,500 years from beginning to end. There are at least 40, if not many more, authors represented in this book. Authors of all shapes and sizes, from kings to peasants, and everybody else in between. Geographically, it spans three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And it's written in three different languages too, ancient Hebrew, a little bit in Aramaic, and then ancient Greek in the New Testament. Well, I haven't kept up, have we? And within it we find many different kinds of literature. It's not all one sort of book we have here. Different literary genres are represented. It's as if a book has been selected from the poetry list, and the books from the history section of the library, some letters, some biographies, various different things are brought together. And this book was a book that was drawn together and recognized over a period of time. It wasn't simply delivered, boom, like this. But over a long time spell, these different books were brought together. And that's something that I can explore in our discussions later, if you'd like to. So within it, if you get a handle on it, why not turn to the title page, which in the Chapel Bible is page IX, whatever that means. It comes after VIII and before X. Just the contents page, and you can see what you've got in front of you when you hold a Bible. It's in two halves that we call the Old Testament and the New Testament. And all of those confusing names there are books of a different kind. The first five tell the ancient primeval history of the world and the law that God gave to one particular nation, Israel. The Bible then tells us the story, the history of that nation, and it does it twice. It goes through it once, and then it rewinds a bit and recaps and takes us a bit further. In the Bible, then, we then find the collections of wisdom and worship to help us live our lives. And then the final section of the Old Testament includes what we call the prophets, who are people we believe were sent by God over the years to warn Israel and encourage Israel as they struggled to follow their God. Then between the Old and the New Testament, there's a gap of about 400 years. And then we find collected together some different kinds of books. It's in the New Testament, the first four books, that we find the account of the ministry of Jesus. And although they're towards the end of the book, they're in the middle of God's plan. Because ultimately the Bible is a book about Jesus, enabling us to understand him. After those four Gospels, there comes an account of the early church. Then a collection of letters by apostles and various other people, other apostles, to early Christians. And then at the end, there's that mysterious, exciting, spooky book that we call the Book of Revelation, that I'm sure you have heard of. So you can see there a picture of the diversity of the Bible. It's very different, for instance, from the Quran, because the Quran is understood to be a series of revelations given to one particular person in his lifestyle and in his lifetime. Whereas this is a book of such variety, drawn together in this way. Now, it's important that we see how the Bible talks about itself. Because we would be completely crazy if we went around saying the Bible is the Word of God and can be trusted and believed, if the Bible itself made no such claim. That would simply be ridiculous, wouldn't it? But as we look at the Bible, we find that written into it all the way through is an assumption that God is speaking through these pages. Sometimes it's explicit, sometimes it is underneath the surface. And these things come to a culmination towards the end of the New Testament, with the books written by apostles and others, towards the very end, sort of summarizing and wrapping up what this whole book has all been about. And these are some of the things that the Bible has to say about itself. So the Apostle Peter, that friend of Jesus, he says, "Men spoke from God as they were carried along by the Holy Spirit." An unknown writer to the Hebrews says, "In the past God spoke through the prophets at many times and in different ways." And the Apostle Paul summarized it by saying, "All scripture is God-inspired, God-breathed is the word, and useful for our lives." So that's the way the Bible describes itself. And we are not making something up for it, making claims for it, that the Bible itself doesn't make. So what is it? What is this crazy idea that we are, as evangelical Christians, putting forward? Well, we need to understand, of course, that there are many flavours of Christian in our world today, and others do not necessarily take the Bible as their starting point for what they believe. But here in this church, and we believe the authentic expression of Christianity, is what we call evangelical Christian faith. And that's a faith based upon the Bible as our starting point and our finishing point for understanding God, life, the world, everything. We believe, from the kind of verses we've just read, that the Bible was written down by human beings. It's a human book. And we find their personalities and characters all the way through. Yet we believe that God, by his Holy Spirit, was working through those people to inspire them to write what he wanted written. That's why we might call it God's written word, written through people like living pens, yet his thoughts, his message. And we believe because it is written by God, effectively, that therefore it can be relied upon, that it is trustworthy, that it's not going to lead us up the garden path or be riddled with ridiculous errors. For Christians, it's the final authority for what we believe. Of course, we get information from all sorts of sources, but it's through the Bible that we decide what we trust and put our faith in or not. We believe that it's through the Bible primarily that God speaks to us today. That through the Bible, God's words come alive so that he is speaking to us in a living way, not just a sort of historical way. Most importantly, perhaps, it's through the Bible that we come to know Jesus Christ. Because God has made his existence plain in creation, And he's written his word so we can understand him. But most of all, he's come to us as a person, Jesus Christ, so that we can know him as a person and therefore know God as a person. And in believing it, we're following the example of Jesus himself. Because as we look at Jesus' life and character, we see that he trusted the Bible implicitly, beginning to end. So that's what we are saying and claiming here. And I fully admit and understand that this is a strange and difficult thing to believe if we're new to all of this. Incidentally, could I have that strip of spotlights off, please? Because they bake my head while I'm talking. Thank you. The spotlights, not the strip light. Thank you. How on earth can you believe something that seems so crazy to the modern Western world, modern Western mind? These are the sorts of obvious questions that come along, aren't they? The first question, well, what we've got here, I mean, how do we know it's the original version at all? How do we know it's not been changed, bits have been dropped and added over the years? How can we put our confidence in this book? An obvious question. I'm often asked it. And people will say, of course, well, it's a book thousands of years old. Surely it's full of errors, mistakes. It says things about the world that are patently untrue to our minds. Again, who hasn't wrestled with questions of that kind? Not only that, people will think, but also it's riddled with internal inconsistencies. So one book says one thing and another bit says another thing and you can't match them up. And then there's our thought in our minds that even if those things aren't the case, surely a book that's that old is going to be completely obsolete and irrelevant and have very little that's useful to say to life today. We might be able to pick out a few pithy, juicy statements or wise observations, but the thing as a whole, well, that's a historical textbook at best, isn't it? It's these four questions I'm going to try and tackle now. We'll see how far we get. Some of it will cut if I can't fit it all in. This first bit, we can't help but be a little bit technical about. Is this Bible we've got in front of us the original version? Well, it is certainly true that we don't have the original texts written down by the first Bible writers. This is probably a very good thing, because if we did, there'd be some shrine somewhere and a long queue of people all bowing down and kissing it and so on. Because that's what we tend to do with religious relics. But although we don't have the original texts by the original authors, we do have thousands of early copies of them, written down very carefully by scribes who in the main were treating each and every single word as inspired by God and therefore not wanting to make a single mistake. Now, there is a time gap between those original writing and the earliest copies that we've got. And broadly speaking, 200 to at most 400 years is the length of that time gap. But, as we'll see in a moment, that time gap is trivial compared to the gap for nearly all the other ancient documents that we have. And I'll show you that in a moment. People will say, all those ancient copies, they have little errors in them, little minor copying errors. And indeed, there is some truth in that. There are some little copying errors in parts of the Bible. But the thing is, it's very easy to spot them. The vast majority of the little errors in copying in the Bible are simple variations in spelling, that sort of thing. In other places, you can see where someone has made a human mistake. So, for instance, a sentence contains the same word in two places. They write up to the sentence, and then their eye skips to the next word, and they finish it off, missing a little section out. In one or two other places, where the Bible has seemed to say something that's a bit strange to the scribe, then they've thought, no, it can't say that, and they've changed it. And we know they've done that because we found those copies in the rubbish dump, where they threw the copies that weren't correct, you see? Oh, but people say, they were written in ancient languages. How on earth can we really understand? And the answer to that is quite straightforward. This is the sort of thing that scholars and theologians and supposedly pastors do in our theological colleges is learning to read and understand Hebrew and Greek, the languages the Bible was written in. And although there are still plenty of interesting questions to chew over, broadly speaking, we have very good translations into English and most other major languages that help us understand and know what the Bible actually says. And when your theologians and pastors do their work, they're supposed, at least, to actually go back to the original to grasp what the Bible actually says and not rely on the translations in any case. Just so you can see how the Bible shapes up, look at this comparison with some other ancient documents. And these are typical examples, all right, of other ancient documents. They're not picked because they were especially weak. So the works of Plato, for instance, are written, as you can see, 47 to 347 BC. The earliest copy we have of that, it was written in 900 AD. So that's a time span of 1,200 years. And we have a total of 7 ancient copies of Plato. Caesar's Wars, 100 to 44 BC, 900 AD, a 1,000-year time gap, 10 copies. Homer's Iliad, 900 BC, 400 BC, 500 years, 643 ancient copies. The New Testament, AD 40 to 100, depending on which part of it we're looking at. And the earliest copies, AD 125 for the earliest fragments, to AD 400 for the earliest complete thing. So that's a time span of 25 years for the smallest fractions segments that we have, to 300 for the whole thing. How many ancient copies? Well, it depends what you count as ancient, of course. But we're talking 20-odd thousand ancient copies. The scholars don't worry that we haven't got good copies of Homer, or Caesar, or Plato, or all these other ancient books. Do we really need to worry about the New Testament, if that's the case? Could say similar things about the Old Testament. Grill me about that afterwards, later on. But I think that we're not being stupid to believe that this book here is a good and faithful record of what was originally written. Okay, well, that was a fairly technical explanation, and you can come back at me after that. Let's have a look at actually what the Bible says now, because I want us to have a think about this obvious question, whether the Bible is full of errors in its description of truth and reality and the world around us. Because if it were, then we would start to wonder whether God really was behind it after all, and certainly whether we could put our trust in it. Now, I'd like us to look at this section, the Gospel of Luke. You'll find this on page 1025, partly because it's an account of the life of Jesus, which is the place we need to start in understanding the Bible, and also because a few verses here draw together in a straightforward way what the Apostle Luke was setting out to do. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you some questions, so read carefully, listen carefully. This is how Luke introduced his writing, and it also introduces the book of Acts that he wrote to follow on. He said, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught." So that's Luke's explanation of what he is setting out to do as he writes this gospel. Okay, I hope you paid attention. Keep it open. I have some questions for you now. They're not hard questions, but just to make sure that you stay awake. First question then, who was Luke? Well, actually, I'm going to tell you the answer to that one because it doesn't say in this section. Luke was a young man who joined the Apostle Paul as he went around preaching the good news. See what it says. He was a doctor by profession, we believe, a professional man. And he wrote both the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. Let me ask you a question then. What kind of writer did he try to be? What kind of author was he setting out to be as he wrote the Bible? By his own understanding of himself, anyway. Reliable? Rigorous. Investigative. He sets himself up, at least, as someone who is making a serious scrutiny and then setting out an orderly and reliable account. That's what he says he's doing. He might not actually be doing that. He might have been incompetent. He might have been trying to stitch us up. But at face value, when you read a book, you tend to take the author's, you know, you start with where the author says he's at. Why did he write it then? What was his goal? Feel free to call it out. Verse 4, yeah. What conclusions did he want his writer, his readers, to gather from what he had written? Yeah. It says in verse 4, doesn't it? So that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. That's his goal. Unashamedly, he wants to tell people a truth that they can believe in, that he himself is confident is true, and that they can put their confidence in. Again, that's his version of what he's setting out to do. Okay? Important question then. Where did he get his information? Where did he get his information? Sorry? Eyewitnesses, that's right. Were there any other potential sources? The eyewitnesses and servants of the Lord are probably much the same people. He also says that other things, other accounts of Jesus' life were written down, doesn't he? So potentially he could have been examining those in the in his work. So Luke himself doesn't claim to have been there on the spot. He claims to have sorted through and spoken to all these different eyewitnesses and potentially at least seen some other accounts of Jesus' life. So he tells us where he gets his information from. How could his work be checked then? By the other writers and by those eyewitnesses who were still around. Isn't that interesting? Actually, in some ways, this is more reliable than someone who simply comes along and says, I wrote this all myself. This is someone who comes along and says, I've researched this. And people could then compare what he had to say with the eyewitnesses who could have said, no, that's a load of rubbish, or you've embellished that, and so on. So was he a neutral, objective writer? Was he someone who had no particular agenda? No. And he doesn't claim to be. And the thing we have to grasp is, nobody is a neutral, objective writer about anything. There is no such thing. We ask for some kind of neutral account of the life of Jesus, but it could not exist. You would either believe in him, in which case you'd write positively, or you would not believe him, in which case you'd write negatively. There's no such thing as a neutral account. But the point is, Luke tells you exactly where he's coming from. You know where he stands. Now, if I'm a supporter of Norwich City, I might say to you, Norwich City is the best football club in the whole world. You would understand that my opinion of Norwich City was biased by my own personal commitment. You'd then ask me, what was the score yesterday? And there's only one answer I can give. What was it now, John? 2-0 down, lost 2-0. That's it. Doesn't matter how much I love Norwich City, I have to tell you the truth about the score. Luke is telling us the information. He's not telling us his opinion. He's telling us the information. And whether or not he believes it, or rather the fact that he believes it, does not mean that it's not true. It is more like the football score than about the football, the footballing supporter. So Luke was a serious historian. What's the next bit? There we go. Sorry, pressed the wrong button. Come back. Ah, my mistake. If you look at the big picture, you find that what he had to write is consistent with life in the ancient world. It's consistent with other authors at the time. There weren't a lot, but there were some. Here is what one ancient author wrote specifically about Jesus. This is perhaps the most important extra-biblical testimony to Jesus. A historian named Flavius Josephus, Jewish historian, very biased, but he admits it too. He says, now about this time there lived a wise man called Jesus. Indeed, he was a man who performed startling feats. He was a teacher of the people, and he drew many from among both the Jews and Greeks. Governor Pilate, on the basis of charges laid against him by our neighbours, condemned him to a cross. For, it is reported, he appeared to them alive again, and the group of Christians named after him has still not disappeared to this day. This guy was not a Christian. But that's what he wrote about those events. So it's consistent with what the other people were writing. We find that Luke was consistent with archaeological evidence, and on occasions where people think that he got things wrong, they've been proved right, and I can give you examples later if you want. And remaining uncertainties, and there are some, I fully admit, do have potentially very reasonable explanations for them. So I think we can conclude that Luke, at least, was a very reliable author, someone we can put our faith in. And you have to ask this question, why do people not believe in him? And I suggest to you the answer why so many, including historians and experts, don't put their faith in him, is that they come to the Bible with a presupposition. They come having already decided that miracles and things like that do not happen. That a God like that doesn't exist. If you come at it with that as your assumption from the very beginning, then of course you don't then conclude that Luke is a reliable author. Because you think, well, he must have been confused or making things up. But if you're willing to say, okay, this universe is big enough that just possibly things happen that I have never seen and can't be explained by science. If you're willing to come at it with an open mind, then there is no reason at all to disbelieve what Luke has to say. Now, we could say more. We could say how the Bible as a whole has stood the test of time in spite of attempts to disprove it. For example, in that first section. No, I don't want an example there. Bear with me a second. We could say that there is good reason to believe that the remaining problems, of which there are, have answers. And we can discover these answers. Firstly, when we find something that doesn't seem to fit up with the world around us, we need to go back to the Bible and make sure that we've understood it right in the first place. That's what happened, for instance, in the episode with Galileo. The church believed, based on on various verses in the Old Testament particularly, that the planet Earth was the centre of the universe and everything else went round it. Galileo and various others said, no, you know what it's like, the sun's in the middle and everything else goes round the sun. Galileo was threatened with torture for teaching such a thing. And the inquisitors refused to look down his telescope that proved that the Earth really did go round the sun. The problem was the fact that they hadn't read the Bible carefully enough. They should have looked at the evidence and then gone back to the Bible to check that they'd understood it correctly and seen that actually those verses in the Psalms and so on were never intended to assert that the world is at the centre of the universe. They were simply poetic ways of describing the universe. But then, of course, when somebody comes along and says they found something that contradicts the Bible, we always need to actually hold our fire and look and see what the evidence actually is. Because time and time again, as we've examined the evidence more closely, we find that the Bible's account of things holds good. Let me give you an example. For quite a long time, people were thoroughly sceptical about whether the Bible character Abraham even existed, whether there were even any cities in the places where he was supposed to have been, until somebody went and actually dug in the right place. And they found them. And all of a sudden, the Bible is shown to be thoroughly consistent with the evidence, or rather the other way around. And then I find that when we've examined the difficulties like this and found that many of them are answered so thoroughly, then those remaining difficulties, of which there are some, I fully admit, we can comfortably leave and wait for new answers to emerge. So, for instance, the Exodus, when Israel is brought out of Egypt. At the moment, we haven't yet found any archaeological evidence for thousands of people wandering through the desert at that particular point in history. There just isn't any evidence at the moment outside the Bible. But that doesn't worry me too much. Because for every piece of evidence there is, there are 100 pieces of evidence that have been lost. And I'm fully confident that there'll come a time when we do dig in the right place. We do redate some information that's already there. And we see that once again, the Bible hasn't made a gross mistake. And let me put the boot on the other foot. Because you see, the Bible says all kinds of things that mere human authors could never have known. For instance, it says things about the natural world, which we've only really learned and worked out very recently. How, for instance, does the Bible know that all human beings are the same species? Is that the conclusion you would draw when you saw all the different tribes and nations and colours of people that we find in this world? Yet before genetics ever came along, the Bible has said very clearly that we all come from one family. And what about the whole issue of prophecy? The whole way in which the Bible isn't just accurate about the past, but manages to say things about the future. There's stacks of it in the Old Testament, but let's have another look, section in the New Testament, just to give you one example of what I mean. Since we're in Luke anyway, let's turn ahead to Luke chapter 19, verses 41 to 44. This is Jesus himself speaking. And he says, "As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, 'If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you.'" In the year 70 AD, the Roman general, I've forgotten his name now, swept into Jerusalem, into Israel, besieged Jerusalem, and after a couple of years, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed, just as Jesus describes about 40 years before. And we can pick out example after example in the Bible of ways in which future events are predicted. So I think we should consider what kind of book the Bible is. A book written by so many different people of such an ancient lineage. Really, a book like that ought to be full of palpable nonsense. We might be able to pick out a few useful things amongst it, but a book like that really ought to say all kinds of other rubbish too, shouldn't it? If it was just a mere human book. But it's not. The amazing thing is not that there are still some things that we struggle to work out. The amazing thing is how consistently reliable the Bible is on so many matters. So once again, we have to ask the question, why not believe it? Is it because we have already assumed it isn't true? Or is it really because we've looked at it and found it wanting? Time and time again, when people have actually done that with an open mind, not deciding already what it says, they have found something very different to what they expected. Well, let's have a pause at this point. Let's stand together and sing. And it's a word, please feel free to join the next point, because I want to finish on something important. The next accusation, the Bible is riddled with inconsistencies. And we have to start off by saying, yes, at face value, different parts of the Bible may well seem to say different things. The most obvious one that popped into my mind was the thought that in the Old Testament it says that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth was the rule. But in the New Testament, Jesus said, turn the other cheek. And you think, well, how on earth can those two things be squared up? At face value, there seems to be a bit of a contradiction in the Bible's moral message, doesn't it? But as you get to understand things a little bit clearer, you find that a great deal of the apparent inconsistencies in the Bible actually disappear. Most importantly, when you read them in context. You see, when you read them in context, you get to see what was actually being meant, rather than simply a few set of words dragged out and compared to each other. So that Old Testament rule, it wasn't meaning to govern every aspect of life, but it was the principle that informed crime and punishment in society. In fact, it said that the punishment should be proportional to the crime. Which of us disagrees with that? Whereas Jesus, we find, is addressing our own personal attitude to other people, that we should be loving towards others and accept wounds from them and return love to them. So we see, they're not contradictory because they're talking about different things. Crime and punishment in society and personal conduct towards other people. There is no contradiction. A great deal of the apparent inconsistencies that get cited actually disappear when you read them in the context in which they're written. And those which don't disappear have thoroughly reasonable explanations, normally, I tend to find. And I'm not going to give examples here because time is whizzing by, but I will do so over pizzas if you wish. Once again, I fully admit there are some which are hard to explain. Apparent inconsistencies for which the obvious answer doesn't jump up and grab you. But few of them are of any significance at all in terms of the Bible's overall message. And once again, I want to say, if you found a book that is consistent again and again and again, and where you find an inconsistency, you go back and discover that actually, no, it does make sense. When then you do come across something that doesn't immediately jump up and explain itself to you, do you conclude that, ha, the whole thing is wrong? Or do you conclude that you've got a bit more work to do before you can find out what it means to say? I'm inclined to conclude the latter. I'm not going to ask for examples now because time is whizzing by. But over pizzas, if you want to try out and find out the gaps in my knowledge, then you're welcome to do so. Incidentally, I have to tell you, I'm not an expert in the Bible. I'm not someone who is a thoroughly in-depth scholar in these things, but I use it quite a lot. So I can try and explain how it seems to make sense to me, and if not, go and find out what the answers are. Once again, I want to say, just think about what kind of book we're talking about. A book of so many different kinds, by so many different authors, over such a wide span. So much of it written without any knowledge of what the others have to say. Not even aware sometimes that they were writing something that would end up in the Bible. Is the surprising thing the fact that some things don't readily fit together straight away? No. The amazing thing about the Bible is the way in which it fits together so wonderfully well. The way in which such an incredibly diverse set of books is brought together. And if you don't believe me, I challenge you to head down to the library. Wander around all the different sections, the histories and the biographies and the poetry and so on, and try to find yourself 66 books that have a coherent message. Try and do it deliberately. No. You could never do so, could you? The amazing thing is how consistent it is. So again, we have to ask, why not believe it? Why not believe it? Unless you've decided already that you don't want it to all hang together. My last point then. Is the Bible obsolete and irrelevant? Well, I put it to you, first of all, that any book that addresses the issues of timeless spiritual truth cannot be obsolete and irrelevant. If it's telling you the truth about things that don't change, like God and eternity and the human race, then how can it be obsolete and irrelevant? Maybe some of the language and literary style isn't very up to date, but surely truths that never change are always relevant to today. The Bible addresses issues of modern human society. You can see going on in the world around us. As I suggested this morning, and often suggest, we see a general moral decay in our society. Not a total moral decay, because some aspects do get better. You can't tell racist jokes now like you used to be able to. That's a good thing. But in many respects, society is swirling down, isn't it? You don't need to read the whole Bible to find a better way. You just have to read 10 verses, the 10 commandments. In fact, the world would be a much better place if people just obeyed 2 or 3 of those commandments, wouldn't it? Of course, it's incredibly up-to-date and relevant to modern human society. I'm constantly amazed at how relevant it is. The Bible addresses issues of your personal human experience as well. I don't know what you did when you first got the internet, if you ever have had the internet, and discovered what Google could do. I don't know about what the first thing you typed in was, but I will confess to you what the first thing I typed into Google. 2 words. Tom Chapman. Can I ask, has anybody else done that? I see some hands going up, yeah? Not Tom Chapman, no, I can understand. If not, you can go and look, but there are some other characters called Tom Chapman who are not... anyway, won't say anything about that. You like to read a book with yourself in it, don't you? I did the same when our history book came out. I must confess, I didn't turn to page 1, I turned to page 23 or whatever it was to see what was written about Tom Chapman. And the thing that really hooked me by the Bible was when I opened the pages and found Tom Chapman described in page after page after page. When I found Tom Chapman's hopes and dreams and fears. When I found Tom Chapman's failings and sins. When I found an analysis of Tom Chapman's thinking and of his heart. I found a book that I could not walk away from. What's more, I didn't just find Tom Chapman. I found a much bigger character too. Somebody who knew Tom Chapman through and through and had the answers which he desired. And a person who, for me, almost walked off the pages of the Bible and became somebody real, who I couldn't just walk away from or ignore. That person called Jesus Christ. Now, you see, we're all in the same boat when it comes to ancient documents and archaeology and all of that kind of thing. None of us know what we're talking about, really. I mean, I find out my information by looking in books like the rest of you might. Very, very few of us are experts. When it comes to looking at the world, well, perhaps we can grasp a bit more about that, because most of us live in the real world, but still, it's a big place. We can't really understand everything that's going on. But we can look at ourselves, can't we? And we can see whether the words in this book actually address you and me and speak to you and me, and whether you encounter somebody through the words in this book who comes alive to you and whom you can put your faith in. Take it from me, the Bible is not obsolete and irrelevant. I preach about it quite a lot, and you may have noticed I don't normally run out of anything to say when I do so. The hard thing for me is to cut out some of the things that I want to say. The amazing thing is that this ancient book speaks to us in such a relevant way now. So why don't you believe it? Is it because you don't want to find something unpleasant about yourself? Wouldn't you rather find, though, something wonderful about Jesus Christ? Someone you can trust and put your faith in.